Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I know this is not an expected broadcast. I really wouldn't expect it for me. This is a bonus. It's free to patrons. It's just an extra on the lineup. Our regular show will air, as always, on Tuesday. We're doing a broadcast called Women Beyond Belief. But today, I was having a conversation with David Smalley, host of Dogma Debate. It was a personal conversation. And we were just talking like friends. And I honestly thought, what if we were just to start recording? Like, what if we had this conversation so that everybody else could listen in? And because I felt like in a time when conflict resolution, the ideas of positive conflict, of respectful disagreement, when these things seem to be dying or dead out there, especially on the internet, maybe somebody might be compelled by and entertained by and benefit from listening in, sort of peering into the windows and listening to David and I talk about this stuff. And so he and I agreed to just roll, and what you're about to hear is a conversation about recent online dust-ups and some controversy and this and that, some conflict that needs resolution. It's Smalley and me just talking it out like friends, like real people, and you get to listen in. So I hope you enjoy. Host of Dogma Debate, David Smalley. Thanks for being here, David.
Seth, it's always a pleasure. I love talking to you, man.
We've been friends for, I don't know how many years now. It's been 5 years, 6 years ago, something like that.
I think I met you. I think you were a year ahead of me on all of this. I remember you being like, when I started my podcast, you were the only one I could find. It was you and Matt. So I would say it's been at least 5 years. Yeah. Because I've had this show for six.
Did Talissa and everybody do Halloween? You guys all dress up and go do the...
You know, my kids are older now.
No, that's no excuse.
No. What they do, they dress up. They just don't want me around. So they get all, you know, they look amazing. And then they just go. She's 13. My son's about to be 18.
Okay, I get it. And
so they were just like, yeah, we're going partying. Okay, bye. Okay,
yeah, nice. Yeah. Later. You're not cool anymore, Dad. It's funny, we were here, right? We're in this new neighborhood because we moved in the spring and we didn't know what to expect trick-or-treater-wise. I've got the house totally decked out with, you know, I've got the tombstones out front and I've bathed the entire house in red light, crimson light, and I got a fog machine. And I love the holiday. I have no idea what to expect. And it was insane. I mean, the doorbell kept ringing and ringing. And all of a sudden, I kid you not, pulling around the corner was a truck pulling a flatbed trailer with like 20 kids on it. I don't know if they carted them in from another neighborhood. Was it a church group or something? So 20 kids come up and we run out of candy. Natalie hops in the car. She's blowing over to, you know, Walgreens or whatever to try to replenish. And I've got nothing. I'm going through the pantry and I'm already picturing it in my mind. I'm like,
you got to turn off the lights.
No. I was desperate enough. It was like, hey, look, would you like some frosted mini wheats? You know what I'm saying? Look, it's lunch meat with Swiss here. Happy Halloween. It was terrifying. And fortunately, she came back. We saved the day. No child went hungry. But now I'm surrounded by sugar. Do you guys have leftovers?
Talissa comes home every Halloween with a giant bag of candy. And she pours it all out on the floor and then separates it out. She knows what everybody's favorite candy is. And so she makes us all our little bowls, our bowls of our favorite candy. And so, yeah, it's adorable. And so she even made one for her brother. And it was really cute. She took a whole bag of candy up to her brother's room and just laid it on his bed. And
I look at all these young kids eating the candy and I think to myself, I remember back when I had a metabolism. Yeah, I miss those days. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You look at that bowl totally differently now.
Yeah.
It looks like and neck
moment fat on the lips, lifetime on the hips, pretty much. So the reason you and I are just rolling here as just buddies, we the short version of a longer story is that there was the last 3 months on Twitter has been just the twilight zone in the atheist movement. It's been pretty wild out there. But there was an exchange recently, and, you know, you and I were pretty frank and candid with each other. You and I are buddies. We're friends. We've known each other for a while. I'm a fan of Dogma Debate, and I've been excited for you and your opportunities with Podcast One. And you were part of my 300th broadcast last year. And you and I, we crossed paths. I like your style. I like the fact that you speak so much to believers. You lead with compassion when it comes to so many of these discussions. So while we don't always line up, I'm a fan, right? And you've been very supportive of the Thinking Atheist, and I appreciate that. But, you know, there was a point of disagreement that we had, sort of publicly, just a little bit. I was like, you know, Dave, I've got a concern about this. And you're like, well, here's what I'm thinking. And then I sent you a private message, and we actually had some private dialogue, like real people, right?
And
I, instead of trashing each other on the internet, reached out one-on-one, had a conversation, and then the universe exploded because nobody seems to do this in the internet age. It's too busy wanting to choose sides and vilify and amplify and escalate. I'm exhausted, David. I'm exhausted from all the bitching and the moaning and the infighting and the escalation and all the insanity out there. So I was hesitant to even do this show. I got Natalie over here going, hey, wait a minute. You're going to talk to Dave and you're going to record and you may release this as a show. How much do you want more grief in your life? And I'm trying to explain to her, yeah, but I want to lead by example to sort of present how two people can disagree and talk through the disagreement. We don't have to be enemies to perhaps even be opponents on specific ideas. And she's like, you know, you're nuts. So, yeah. Did you ever catch that at home? Like, Dave, what are you doing?
All the time. All the time. And here's what I keep coming back to. When we push back against Christianity, and it's important to remember how long we've been doing this, because when we first started this, all the pushback we got was from Christians and our Christian family members and people that we come across in our daily lives telling us that we were doing the work of Satan and that we should just shut up and why don't you just let people believe what they want to believe? And there was so much pushback, but we fought through it anyway because we wanted to see an end that was peaceful. We know that there are human beings inside those Christians who believe things that may or may not be their fault. And so we want to reach into that aspect of the community and say, you know, what you're believing, what you're doing is hurtful to someone else. Can we talk about it? And it used to be that we were sort of being beaten over the head by people on the outside. And now, I think the best way I've heard it explained was that you and I are in the garage trying to get the wasp nest out, and half of our community is beating us over the back with the broom telling us we're not doing it right. And so when we have a disagreement and I see those people who know my character, who have worked with me personally on whether it be charity events or helping to rescue someone from a troubling abusive home or whatever, they themselves needed help, whether it be financially or emotional. I've been there for these folks. They've been there for me. We have been a family. To see those people go online and say things like, David Smalley is a piece of shit, or he is a rape defender, or he is a Nazi, or he is a garbage human being.
Yeah, but how many of these people, Dave, are friends? Like, you know, we've all seen, I call them the outrage brigade, and it's amazing to watch people borrow that term to imply that I don't think there are instances in this world where people should be justifiably outraged. Hell, you know, there are a great many of them. But there are some people where outrage is their currency. Escalation is their currency. There's no attempt to listen with a charitable ear. There's no desire to come to a point of understanding. The end game is not to better each other as much as it is just to froth and accuse and character assassinate. Many of these people, certainly not all, but many of these people are attempting, I think, to raise their own profiles by tearing away at the profiles of other people. Maybe somebody's virtue signaling, trying to puff themselves up. Maybe it's performance Facebook drama for its own sake. And already I can see there's somebody who's completely taken a portion of what I just said and ran with it, and they're already hammering out the hate mail. I'm talking about the gleeful agents of escalation out there, the people who are not interested in building bridges or repairing bridges. They only want to burn the bridges so that they can bask in the glow of the flames, okay? And quite frankly, they thrive on chaos, drama feeding on itself. I mean, do you spend time on these people? Because they will suck your time and energy.
I've removed myself from Facebook. I can't do it anymore.
That's not my question. Do you engage with these people? Is my question.
That's what I was getting to. When someone sends me a screenshot of a Facebook message from someone that I thought I was close with saying horrible things, then yeah, that sometimes I do feel the need to reach out. And I think the only reason I feel the need to is because I consider them family and it hurts.
Well, I buy that. If it's somebody that you know and somebody you've had a relationship with and you want to address that, I'm not saying that these people run completely unchecked. But, there does seem to be a group of people who, you know, they're just going to throw stones from the cheap seats no matter what we do, no matter what happens.
Oh, of course. Well, I got to meet one of my online harassers in person the other day. I didn't get a chance to tell you this when we talked. I went to an event and that person was there. I didn't know who he was. I didn't recognize him. He points at me and says, "You." I look at him and I went, "Okay." He jumps up, he runs around to my chair, and he said, "I have been so mean to you online, and I am so sorry." And I shook his hand, and I went, "Okay, a lot of people are, man. I don't know what you're talking about."
And, take a number, man.
Yeah, I have no clue. I promise you I haven't lost sleep over it, but I would love to know.
All right.
Come to find out, he was a serial harasser who had been on my page, on my Twitter, on our Facebook. Someone could post, "Great episode, David. I really loved the compassion you showed to that one guy." And then his comment would be, "It's amazing that a guy with so much compassion for one can be so hateful and nasty to another. Why don't you grow up, David Smalley?" I'm like, why? Why is this guy being so negative? The admins of the Facebook page eventually came to me and said, "Look, there's a guy that's harassing. He's being negative to everyone. We would like to block him from the page." And I said, "Look, you guys know what you're doing more than I do. I never see it." So they removed him from the page. Of course, he thought I had gone in and removed him.
Okay, wait. So the people who were adminning your Facebook page for you wanted to block him?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
As they were saying, every time anything positive happens, he comes there and says, "Yeah, but David Smalley is an actual piece of trash person who is horrible and mean and yada, yada, yada." Mm. And so I stood in a parking lot last week for 4 hours and I gave this guy my time, because just like when I sit across from a Christian, I don't think that they believe what they believe because they're awful people. I think that there's a reason, there's something causing that person to be the way they are. And I want to get to the bottom of that, almost as if to rescue them from the mindset. And so I spend my time talking with this guy, and he keeps telling me this sort of that he has sort of, and I see this in so many of these folks. And so it was eye-opening to talk with him. He said he sees it as his job. If he sees anything wrong with something that I do or you do, because you did come up, that it's his job to not only not support what you do, but to, you know, pull financial support and then to stand at the entrance of your storefront and tell everyone coming in and out that you are not worthy of support, and to try to shut you down, to stop you from having your own platform because he disagrees with it.
So, I mean, how much of this, though, do you think is this guy just puffing himself up? Hey, you know, look how important I am. I'm here as I'm sort of the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
I mean, did you sense that? I mean, what drives that?
I didn't. What I sensed was, and I hate to tie this together, but the Antifa mindset is, we will expose Nazis, we will tear down Nazis, we will, you know, because there's some sheriff somewhere who is a KKK member and nobody knows it. And the idea is expose that guy, tell what he's been doing. I agree with that. But that mindset then rolls over into Seth Andrews spoke out against Antifa, therefore he must be a closeted Nazi. Get him. David Smalley said maybe there was another reason behind the cheer, so David must be okay with rape. Get him.
Okay, all right. Sam Harris
disagreed with the methodology of Black Lives Matter, therefore he hates black people. Get him.
All right. Well, we're going to have to give a little bit of backstory for the three people who don't know what we're talking about. When you mention the tweet, sure. I brought Sam Harris up on the recent broadcast. You and I line up. You know, Sam is a far from perfect guy, but he is also a tremendous advocate for science, reason, and the evidence. Despite his flaws, he is not the devil. And yet, going after Harris in these really clumsy, ham-handed ways has become for many a cottage industry. You know, he's this, he's that, he's a racist, he's all these things. And I just don't buy that. I think we disagree on tactics. You can go back and listen to the broadcast last Tuesday if you're interested. But let's talk about this tweet. Set it up as quickly as you can, David. What happened and what was the blowback? Okay.
Okay. So the short story is the MythCon thing, the Mythicist Milwaukee conference, where Sargon had had the debate and he was being interviewed, and it came up that he had tweeted at a sexual assault victim, who is Jess Phillips, who is a British MP. He tweeted at her, "I wouldn't even rape you," at which made sounded disgusting to me too, and that's what a lot of people are missing. And it got a cheer from the crowd, and there was a lot of talk about everybody who cheered is awful. This is not what our community should represent, and there was this big blow up over that, and that became the discussion after MythCon. People weren't talking about Melissa Chen or Shoe on Head or hardly anything else that happened at the conference. It all centered on the crowd cheering over the tweet, "I wouldn't even rape you." And my tweet was, and again, my mindset, as I was watching this unfold, Seth, I was like, I was sort of giggling internally at the people who were overblowing this conference before it ever even happened. The people who were sending threats to the venue and saying this was going to be Nazi Fest 2017, those were the people I was sort of poking fun at. My tweet said something along the lines of, you know, before MythCon, we were told there were going to be Nazis everywhere. Afterwards, we're talking about a tweet and a cheer. So there were no Nazis? That's what I tweeted. It was to draw attention to the fact that it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. That was the point. And that was actually what launched it. And then a discussion ensued in my tweet thread, essentially accusing me of defending rapists somehow, and that I'm a garbage human being and that I'm a disgrace to the community and all sorts of things. And really, essentially what I ended up replying to a couple of people was that, look, people cheering for that tweet sounded bad to me too. But just like I do with Christians who sit across from me in my studio, when they tell me I have no morality or that my daughter should be given away to a Christian family, all these horrible things people say to me, I look into them and say, is there something causing that? Is there something driving that behavior? So when I first heard them cheer the tweet, I went, oh, that hurts a little. What if there's something else? I'm digging deeper. What if they're just trying to torment Thomas because of all the fighting leading up? What if they're just cheering defiance, period? What if they're cheering Sargon? Sargon could do anything on that stage and get cheered for. What if there's something more? And so everyone who immediately just said, no, these are garbage people because they cheered. That's when I think you and I sort of separated there, and I'll let you tell your side. But I saw that and I went, guys, we're supposed to be about evidence. And them cheering is evidence of the cheer. I don't know that I would say that's evidence of them being garbage human beings. Let's dive a little deeper and see if there's more nuance that caused them to cheer. All of the leading up, all of the fighting that was happening before, we may have looked at this as two guys going on stage to go at it. Their crowds were fighting. Like, Sargon's people were fighting with many of the people who were protesting the whole idea of the conference. And so if you put yourself in the mindset of Sargon's fans, which I know is difficult for a lot of people to do, if you put yourself in there, you know that the whole point of I guess Thomas's whole purpose is going to be to get up there and wipe the floor with Sargon, to destroy his argument. And if you think your guy is going to be attacked, you over the top cheer for anything you can to show Thomas he's not going to win over the crowd. And keep in mind that the folks who were the social justice leaning, or the folks who would have supported Thomas, a large portion of those people boycotted the conference and weren't there. As a matter of fact, they told them not to go. There was a big push for a lot of people, including you. You were pressured. A lot of people were pressured. Don't show up. Don't go. So if they're not going, who do you think is going to be in the crowd?
Yeah, I've no question that it was front loaded for their guy, especially when after Sargon was done, everybody got up and left, or, you know, that huge swath of people all exited the building. Right. They went there for their pet project, for their pet little hour, and then they split.
Right.
I didn't back out, though, because I felt pressured. I backed out because I felt like the conference had become such a circus that on the cost-benefit scale, there was really very little benefit for me. I just thought, this is not why I do conferences. And I know that there were some people who were, they're all going to be like, well, you know, we pushed Seth off the stage or off of the lineup. And I'm like, you know, you can tell yourself that story, but the truth is that I'll go speak wherever I choose to go speak. I had some real concerns growing every day, concerns about just the white noise of the events. I remain concerned about the organizers themselves, what their vision for the movement and our spokespeople should be. And at the end of the day, I was talking to Natalie and I just thought, you know, why do it? Why subject it to lose-lose, no matter how you slice it? I'd rather have a weekend at home with my family, you know what I'm saying, than have to go out there and be a part of something that's become so chaotic. This is not why I do activism. And whether that's a right or wrong decision, I, to this day, I'm not 100%. Maybe I should have gone and taken the stage and made my case. Maybe I should have, you know, hopped on a plane after all and fulfilled my obligation there. Maybe it was a wrong move. I don't know, but I tried as best I could to make the right decision at the end of the day, and I'm the one that's got to live with it, you know? So.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that you didn't go because of pressure.
No. I know there are people in the audience, they're going to knee-jerk themselves right into that, so I wanted to draw a big circle around it.
I appreciate that, and I apologize if I made it sound that.
Not at all.
I thought. My whole point was you were being pressured, whether that caused you to do it or not.
People, that's true. I mean,
shouldn't go.
Now, it was pressured on both sides, right? You should go and counter the awfulness. And other people said anyone who steps foot in the arena is, and then they would just insert a pejorative, just, you know, it's some awful a guilt by association insult, whether it has to do with the Nazis or rape apologists or just some horrible language going on out there. And this is what you're dealing with, right? You're talking about when you were speaking on Twitter, the hugely clumsy forum of Twitter, you are trying to communicate that, hey, they said it would be, some people said that MythCon was going to be a Nazi training camp, a white supremacist rally. It's going to be insane. And people are going to be in danger, so much so that a few people called the hotel, got the hotel staff in a snit, extra security had to be hired, and the event comes off. Nobody is harmed. Yeah, there's some unfortunate stuff that happens from the stage, but what you had mostly was just language, some unfortunate language, but that's all you had. And it was not the Nazi training camp that people had been warning about. So you go on Twitter and you say, hey, where are all the Nazis? Is that accurate? Do I have that right, David?
Yeah, you do.
Okay. Because now the narrative has shifted to, hey, let's talk about the rape-related tweet instead of all the Nazis. You felt like they sort of changed the narrative?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, all right.
And instead of saying not a single person who sounded the alarms that the Nazis were coming, not a single one of them has backstepped and said, okay, you know what? There were no Nazis there. It wasn't an alt-right convention. There were some people there we disagree with, but it wasn't what we thought it was. Absolutely not. There's no acceptance. There's no saying we were wrong. They just shift the outrage to something else.
Yeah, Dave, but
at that point.
Look, the people that say Matt Dillahunty being involved at MythCon as the moderator makes him a Nazi sympathizer. I mean, anybody who would say those things, I don't think is interested in the truth or grounded in reality, This is unnecessary escalation. This is just falsehoods. It's someone's lying. I mean, anyone who knows Matt, and I know Matt, and sees the totality of his work and character, knows that it's hugely wrong. It's hugely wrong to assert that he or anybody else on stage, you know, Aaron Ra, he pulled his name. I was originally involved. People were saying that because we would choose to participate, if we chose to participate, we were enabling violence against women or supporting those who would support violence against women, and they would then make us guilty by association. I don't think those people are listening, Dave. They are sending, they are not receiving.
Well, I think they can, though. And this is the same, it's the same struggle I have when I have a Christian in studio. When these folks are saying these things, I don't think they wake up that morning going, Seth is enabling Nazis. I think that they get involved in social media threads and they get whipped up into a frenzy. And by the time they get to the end of it, now they've decided that you're enabling Nazis. And if you're enabling them to have a platform, then you're sympathetic to their cause. Therefore, they can justify calling you a Nazi sympathizer only 6 or 7 times before you graduate to Nazi. Yeah. And the same people who were calling those venues and sounding the alarms and saying the Nazis are coming, those same people have turned their attention to my network, contacting Podcast One, saying, do you realize you have a Nazi host? Do you realize you've done a deal with an anti-Muslim bigot who is racist? I mean, the same outrage brigade who attacked MythCon are coming after me and directly trying to get my show canceled from my network.
Yeah, but does Podcast One listen to those guys? I mean, anybody who listens to Dogma Debate, I mean, you can have a disagreement about something you've spoken about or, you know, some sort of a philosophical or some other point. But anybody who listens honestly is going to hear them call you a Nazi and a rape apologist and anti-people, anti-woman, anti-whatever. They're going to know that that's bullshit. Like, you and I can disagree about a lot of things, but I don't for a second think that most people would buy any of that. So is anybody in the chain of command listening, you know?
I don't think so. I mean, they did renew my deal 2 days after that happened. So I'm officially renewed and I've got another, you know, contract with Podcast One.
So they're just disrupting the momentum of the pages, or they, you know, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what are the consequences to them sort of trolling you in this way?
So the consequences are that a Facebook post, say, would start off fairly innocuous. David said this, and I disagree with him. And then the comment is, yeah, well, I also heard he said this. Oh, my gosh, wow face. Yeah, guy's been headed to the alt-right for quite some time. Oh, my God, alt-right? Yeah, he has the same talking points as the alt-right. Oh, my God, and he defends rapists? Wait, what? And then 400 comments later, people are saying David Smalley's a piece of shit, and my dearest friends in the world are liking the comments. And I'm going,
Wait, hang on, hold on. Well, first of all, you lost me at alt-right. How are you alt-right? Well, like, I know you, right? Your positions on almost every social issue that I know of are way left. I mean, you're liberal across the board, right? Pretty much?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And on top of that, you say your closest friends are liking the posts that call you a piece of shit. I mean, qualify this for me, because it sounds a bit, I mean, your closest friends, David?
Well, people who were my closest friends about a year ago, I would say.
All right.
People who I would consider brothers and sisters, people who have been on my show multiple times.
Okay. Not just people who were friending you on social media, somebody you knew personally.
Oh, yeah. Someone we've helped financially, who we've helped emotionally, who we've cried on the phone with, cried in person with, people who were with me when I found out John Karf died, the people who were there hugging me in the room, those people, David Smalley is a piece of shit. And that becomes the like. Now, do I think they woke up that morning thinking that about me? No, I don't. But the social media posts and the frenzy was whipped up so much that by the time they were hours into this, it felt like the natural thing to do. And this brings me to something that I've been thinking about for a while. And you mentioned on your last podcast that it's so ridiculous for anyone to call atheism a religion. And I agree with you, because you said, you know, it's about community and gathering. I like community. I like gathering. I would never say that atheism or atheists or these atheists individually are a religion because it's not about the community or the gathering. It's the collective outrage that makes this look like a religion. It's the group psychology, the attacks, the straw man. And here's something I want to connect for you real quick. I'm fortunate enough to be booked with Leah Remini in New York in January.
Oh, nice name drop there, Dave. That's nice. I'm just tweaking you, buddy.
No, I know. I'm saying it because we're doing a whole thing called exposing Scientology. And atheists can look at that and be like, yeah, let's expose Scientology. Well, that's caused me to go watch every single episode of her Scientology The Aftermath twice. And season two just launched. I'm watching all of season two. And Seth, I'd put my phone down. I don't have Facebook on my phone anymore. Nobody's home. I'm by myself. I'm just taking in Scientology The Aftermath, getting prepared for this thing in January. And this thing pops up on the screen where they show the policies of Scientologists. And there's a policy called suppressive reasonableness. And it shows the screenshot of the actual document. And suppressive reasonableness is the inability to confront evil. And I went, wait a minute. I paused the TV and just stared at it. And I thought, this is what's happening in our community. You can say, of course, I'm not a Nazi. You can say I am anti-Nazi. And I didn't even think we had to say that in today's world. But you can say it doesn't matter. If you don't have the ability or the desire to jump up and call out anything that someone else decides is evil, then you are suppressively reasonable, a suppressive, reasonable person. You have so much reasonableness that you refuse to call out evil. That is what happens. Because I won't deem that cheer disgusting, abhorrent human behavior, because I'll say maybe there's something else going on, I then have the inability to confront evil in the minds of my critics, and that makes me a suppressive person. And then when I'm a suppressive person, they can attack and attack and attack, and then they get whipped up in a frenzy, and before you know it, I defend rape, or I excuse sexual harassment, none of which I would ever do.
Oh, yeah. I think anybody who knows you know that's just horseshit, Dave.
That's what I thought, Seth. Yeah. That's what I thought. And that's why I went on the Godless Spell Checker podcast and revealed that I myself had actually been a victim of sexual assault. I wanted to put that story out to say, look, I would never defend rape. I would never defend sexual assault. My problem was I saw people in our community, including you, saying, oh, yeah, they showed their character by cheering. And I just went, oh, maybe they did. But let's leave the door open and say, maybe there's another reason they cheered. And let's talk about the nuance behind that instead of throwing other people away.
I get that. I mean, I understand your point. On some level, I think you and I do line up. Let me tell you why it bothers me, okay? I, in my own mind, can't find any framing of the cheer. I can't find any equivocation, explanation. I can't find any excuse, any reasoning that makes it okay, that makes the people cheering laudable people. In my own mind, I think, well, you know, if they were cheering because they thought it was awesome to cheer a taunt loaded with rape-related language, that's tremendously awful. If they want to derail Thomas, so they're just essentially trolling half of the quote-unquote debate, which wasn't really a debate on stage, that's pretty awful. If they're simply not self-aware, or they're not aware of the consequences of sexual violence and rape-related language, that's pretty awful. There's nothing in my, even if you make it about free speech, right? I heard you say on some level that, well, what if some of the people in the audience were cheering because this was an exercise in speech? And where you're going with that is, I think Sargon's shtick is people don't give offense. Other people take offense, meaning language in itself is not offensive. It's what you take as offensive. And so on the surface, when you say, I won't or wouldn't even rape you, he can say, well, it's declaring that I would never rape someone. It's a statement of nonviolence. But because, of course, language has many layers of subtext that go along with it, and this is what I consider to be a level of plausible deniability. It says this on the surface, but there's so much baggage with this particular phrase, this sentence, that it is loaded with sexual violence all over it. Why would you choose those specific words if you weren't trying to be an antagonist? Why would you phrase it this specific way if you weren't trying to cause real harm to someone who had been threatened with rape hundreds of times online? Why would you do it, and why would you cheer it? In my own mind, I can't see an example of it where it isn't awful. And more than that, Dave, I thought, is this really the hill you want to fight on? Of all the different battles we want to have, do we want to split hairs over the intent of audience members who showed up for one guy and most of which left afterwards and seemed content to troll everybody else online? Do I really care what they think? And, you know, I must admit, on many levels, I have sort of written them off. Like, I have bigger fish to fry. I have more reasonable conversations to have. Anybody who would cheer a rape-related taunt, even one that says, I wouldn't even rape you, in my mind, I don't think you're there for discourse. I don't think you're there for productive dialogue. I don't think you're there to help promote people. I don't think you share my humanistic values. And I'll admit, I mean, right or wrong, at looking at this particular demographic or this group of people and having the thought, you know, I don't know that I really care what you think.
Not once in any of my tweets or messages or conversation with Stephen Knight, none of this, did I ever actually defend the tweet or defend the cheer. I've never said that the cheer was okay.
But you realize, though, by trying to get to, well, we can't know their intent from the cheer. Am I representing you accurately there? Is that what you'd said?
Yes, because here's the reason. It wasn't defending the tweet or defending the cheer or defending Sargon. I'm not defending any of that. My problem was looking at our community, who says we're evidence-based, making an assumption of people's character based on that single action. And I went, wait, I don't think we have enough evidence to say these are garbage human beings who support rape because they cheered. People were also tweeting at me, they cheered for rape. And I would say, I don't think anybody loves rape enough to cheer for it. I think that's a stretch. Maybe there's something else going on. Me saying, this is the most important thing I could say in this entire conversation. Me saying that maybe there is another reason, or I understand there's a different reason for them doing it, is in no way, shape, or form me approving of it, approving of the tweet, or approving of the cheer. I'm just looking at my community having a knee-jerk reaction, making their assumptions about the character of 50 or 60 people without sufficient evidence. And I'm going, guys, we're supposed to ask for evidence. We're supposed to be more nuanced. Let's not automatically think these people are disgusting humans because they did something you and I would never do. I wouldn't cheer for it. I wouldn't tweet that. But me sitting back and saying, maybe there's something else going on here, doesn't mean I agree with it or defend it or prop it up.
All right, let me camp out here. If somebody says those people were cheering for rape, they were pro-rape, and you and I say, well, that's probably not supportable. Like, there are probably some people who are very blasé about sexual violence. Tragically, those people exist in this world. There are some who celebrate it.
Seth, let me stop you there. I think that's the difference between us. You would have said that's probably not supportable, which is a much better response.
Okay,
because you're actually attacking that. What I said was maybe they were cheering for free speech. Maybe they were cheering to taunt Thomas. Maybe they were cheering. I offered other explanations.
Those things may very well be true. Again, you and I probably are lining up on, you know, if they're cheering their guy on stage who is using provocative language. They're cheering the provocation. They're cheering the attitude. I think some of these guys consider themselves to be like, they take a measure of pride in antagonizing simply because they consider it to be some sort of a free speech exercise. Like, the more we push the edges of the envelope of what is acceptable in polite society, the more we are necessary as free speech warriors. I mean, there's some people out there who are selling that stuff. You and I line up on this, okay? Where I think we differ is that we infer intent by what people say and do all the time,
right?
We do it all the time. And so if someone in that audience is cheering a taunt loaded with rape-related language, I'm a little bit quicker to say, you probably have a pretty high asshole factor. You know what I'm saying? No, I'll admit it. I just am probably a little more inclined to do that.
I get that. And I think it's the same way when you're in traffic and somebody cuts you off and you go, what an asshole. This guy, really? You've decided his entire character. He's not making dinner for his kids. He's not a good person. No, I do the same thing. I'm like, what a dick. Oh, why would this guy do this to me?
Well,
and then a few minutes later, I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe he wasn't paying attention. Maybe there was something else going on. Let me frame it like this. I've never talked to Sargon. I was never friends with Sargon. We're not connected in any way. When all of this happened, and I was about to do the show with Steven, I sent Sargon a message. Simply, why do you think the people cheered? Because I know what his answer is for why he sent the tweet. I said, why do you think people cheered for the tweet? And then I didn't see his response. I went on, I did the show. When I finished the show over the last few days, I see a response from him. Let me tell you what Sargon said to me. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know anything about me. Here was his answer, word for word. He said, Thomas's ilk had been terrorizing them, talking about his audience, with the tyranny of their own moral standards. And at this point, people just wanted some way to reject the use of shame as a weapon. This was about my guy versus your guy. This was about my crowd versus your crowd. I'm not going to let you shame somebody on stage into submission. So we're going to cheer at whatever nasty thing that you think. I think they cheered. My personal opinion now, after dealing with this for a couple of weeks, my personal opinion is I think they cheered for that the loudest because that was the worst thing Sargon had done. And if Sargon had done something even worse, they would have cheered for that even more. Because this was about defiance from using shame as a weapon. I do not believe anyone cheered because they are pro-sexual harassment or pro-rape. And I saw so many people in our community saying that, and I just went, guys, we're skeptics. Let's back it up. Let's see if that sounds reasonable.
But so framing it, though, as they were sort of protesting the use of shame as a weapon, props them up, I think, a little more than they deserve to be, does it not? Sargon is not exactly the champion I think this movement deserves. In my opinion, Sargon is an antagonist, and gleefully so, a provocateur for its own sake, not even for healthy reasons, in my opinion.
Which is why it's very important to point out, I still to this day have not defended Sargon, his tweet, or the cheer.
So if they see a provocation of people and knowing that the baggage this language brings is going to be like a razor blade against the sensitive nerves of anybody and everybody who has ever been the victim of sexual violence. You know, we know there are people who have been damaged and who carry the scars with them for their entire lives. And so to hear someone use a rape related taunt, even to say, I wouldn't even rape you, to throw that loaded language in for the purpose of escalation, for the purpose of controversy, for the purpose of turning the screw, knowing the consequences, or maybe they didn't know the consequences, maybe they're not self-aware enough, but I can't find in my own mind any excuse for the cheer itself that doesn't make the cheerer a complete asshole. That's my challenge.
Right. And so that's where we disagree. Let me say, I agree with you that, I mean, I was just as shocked as everyone else when I heard the cheer. I was just as shocked as everyone else when I first read the tweet. I'm with everyone listening on that. But I just pause in that the only reason they could do that is because they are an asshole. That's when I stop and say, haven't you done something? Haven't you ever done something with a different purpose in mind and then realized, oh my gosh, I just came off as a total asshole?
I didn't understand at the time, especially on Twitter, why spend any time defending these guys when there were so many other issues around MythCon that could be discussed. Right. And I think that was my challenge.
So I think what I'm getting from you and from the other people who disagree is that even if they didn't cheer for rape, even if they didn't cheer for harassment, that thing that they were cheering had harassment and the word rape in it, and they should have been self-aware enough to not cheer for it because it came with that poison. And that I understand, I get it, but I still just say that
What if they weren't aware?
What if they weren't aware, or what if they were so caught up in the group mentality that I'm not going to let you shame anybody? Because they had been shamed themselves online as they were trying to defend Sargon on Facebook, and then the social justice folks were attacking the Sargon folks, and they were back and forth of, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You're awful people. I mean, these are blanket statements from Thomas that were addressing the entire audience's character of as who they are as people based off of this cheer. Yeah. And I'm looking at it going, I think they were just trying to get you worked up, man. And it worked. They wanted to throw you off. They wanted to do. Now, looking back on it, some of the people who cheered to shout in the face of defiance, or to say, I'm not going to let you shame us, or your people have been harassing me online for 2 weeks or 2 months, and I'm going to cheer and scream at everything. They might look back at that and go, oh God, it kind of looks like I cheered for rape there. That probably wasn't the best thing. There may be some of those people, but they're awful too. Those are assholes.
Do you think they would come forward? You know, I was wrong. I made a mistake. I mean, I think we would see evidence of some of that, I would hope.
I don't think they would say I was wrong. I think they would say, I'm not cheering for the reasons you thought I was cheering. As a matter of fact, Stephen Knight said from the Godless Spellchecker podcast, said he pulled a clip, an isolated clip, and he sent it to me of... At one point, Thomas turns to the crowd and says, I can't believe you would cheer for that, or you're cheering for rape or sexual assault or something. Someone in the crowd shouts out, that's not why they're cheering. This was
for some, then it felt like it was a pushing of the edge of the free speech envelope to show where the edge was or should be. Is that the general idea?
My point is, we don't know. It could be that. I think it was a mixture of several things. I think that Sargon has a point that these people have been saying shame is a tool against you, and they're going to fight against that. I think that's an aspect of it.
Well, look, I know there's a shade of that in our own movement, Dave. I mean, I'm not saying this is Sargon's idea, because it's not. People have been using loaded language to provoke since the creation of language. So it's not like, you know, Sargon has brought anything new to the table.
It's the same thing, though. We can look at that aspect and say, this is a microcosm. You could take that same sort of, you didn't have the same outrage I have. I'm going to get you. We could do the same thing with sexual assault allegations. We could do the same thing with Scientology. If you're suppressively reasonable, if you have the inability to confront evil, whatever I determine evil to be, if you don't confront it the way I confront it, you must be somehow sympathetic to it.
And yeah, you and I agree. We totally agree. Look, I've seen it. If someone comes forward and says, if you don't respond the way I think you should respond to something I find to be legitimately outrageous, then I'm going to pass judgment upon you as some sort of a sympathizer and a supporter. You are in league with those that we are in opposition to. And people are quite eager to make those judgments. I can't tell if it's because, and so I have theories. One is that I think many people have been so tremendously harmed in their hearts that it's so loaded for them that it's a natural step for them to immediately put up the defense, the wall of defenses, to protect themselves, to protect their issues, and to make sure that the line of demarcation is drawn. On a more sinister note, I think there are others who require a villain against which they might play the hero. So in order for them to elevate their own statuses as these sort of champions, we saw this in the Nazi discussions, you know, they're out there punching Nazis. Like, when's the last time you punched a Nazi? All these guys are all talk anyway. But
Seth, didn't we do the same thing as Christians? If you're not with us, you're against us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We were hugely tribalistic. Yeah.
And so quick to dismiss the mistakes of our own people, right? Give explanations for the shortcomings of our own people. If the pastor commits sexual assault, he apologizes to the congregation, and the congregation says, we stand behind our pastor. He is a sinner. He's a man just like the rest of us, and he has apologized, and he is getting right with God. And then as soon as the atheist across the street commits sexual assault, why did he do it? Because he's an atheist. He did it because he's in the wrong group. This is group psychology 101, and it's very religious.
But how much of, though, I mean, at least in the church, we felt like we were doing it in many ways for noble reasons. There's a culture of people, and this isn't indigenous to atheism. They are gleeful escalators. It's interesting to watch many of the critics of MythCon, and I think Mythicist Milwaukee and MythCon deserves a significant amount of criticism. I think it was a bad idea, poorly executed in many respects.
See, I don't think so. I think that there are parts of it that I would have done differently, but I don't think they deserve a ton of criticism. And that's okay. I mean, you can believe they do.
Well, no. I
can believe they don't, and I don't have to call you a Nazi, and you don't have to say that I defend rape in order for us to see it differently.
You can bring in like Faisal and Azra Nomani to talk about Islam. That's a great idea. Bring in Melissa Chen. Bring in Ron Miscavige, those types of things. But I think the organizers at Mythicist Milwaukee have an idea about what this movement needs in terms of discourse, quote unquote discourse, and there wasn't any, as far as I'm concerned, when Sargon and Thomas were on stage. This is not discourse. Essentially, the MythCon people lost control of their own event. I think that 1 hour slot has tainted. It's become the albatross around the neck for the rest of the convention. And I'd like to see us set a higher bar for what we consider to be the discourse we want to promote. Let's disagree. Hell, let's passionately disagree, but let's make sure the players that we are elevating to the stage to represent quote unquote atheism and discourse and rationality aren't these gleeful provocateurs who were so reckless with language as to use the word rape in such a way.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm fine with that too.
Okay. But back to my original point though about the criticisms of MythCon, Dave, and I don't want to beat the dead horse, but there seems to be an eagerness to align with bad critics, like critics of MythCon who are criticizing it in either awful ways or they're saying untrue or just tremendously intellectually dishonest things, but they're willing to align with those people because they feel like, hey, at least they're in my corner. Yeah, they were calling it a Nazi training camp and calling the hotel and they were having a shit fit about everything and escalating and they were frothing at the mouth and just making the entire thing sound like it was the seventh level of hell. And yeah, they were factually sort of all over the place. And yeah, they kind of lost their shit. And yeah, a lot of that stuff was totally hyperbole, but at least they cared enough to be upset about it. This is something that really concerns me, because what we're doing then is we're willing to sell out the facts. We're willing to sell out the reality of the situation because someone has taken up our pet cause. Yeah, he's an asshole, but he's the asshole who has our back. That, I think, is problematic. Facts do matter, do they not?
Of course they do. Yeah, I'm on board 100%. That's my issue. And that's why I keep going back to this idea that we used to be the ones that would say, no, 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 I require evidence. No, 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 you know, you disagree. Let's publicly disagree. Let's passionately disagree. I can disagree with Christians in my studio. I can disagree with Mormons at my front door. They can tell me that I don't have a basis for morality. And I can say, I understand you feel that way. Here is my basis for morality. And we can have these disagreements. But it seems that any time I disagree with an atheist, it lasts about 30 seconds. And then I'm called the nastiest things you can imagine. I'm a disgrace. I'm a rape defender. I'm a Nazi. I'm all these disgusting things. And then the attack begins. You should stop supporting dogma debate. You should go tell his network he's a Nazi. Christians aren't doing this to me. It's atheists that are doing it to me.
Well, it's
5% disagreement.
It's a few. And I don't know if they're trolling you, Dave, or I mean, I just think
it's not that it's having an effect on me in the way that they want it to. The way it's affecting me is I'm becoming very disappointed in our community's methods, because we used to say, I'm going to withhold my belief or my position until I have sufficient evidence. But now we seem so reactionary, and a larger portion of our population, a larger percentage of our community is okay with being reactionary, because no one wants to be suppressively reasonable. Nobody wants to say, well, maybe, because now it sounds like you're excusing whatever evil is being attacked. And if you excuse whatever evil is being attacked, you become the target of the new attack.
It's interesting, Dave, in the atheist movement to see, and I've been guilty of this sometimes in my own life, when you see an article some sort of a data point that comes out about something that's near and dear to your heart, and you forward it on and you promote it, and then you realize that it was based on a bogus source, or it was debunked, or, you know, you just missed it. And you see that we, as quote unquote enlightened thinkers, as rationalists, are just as guilty as anybody else of bias. We're just as guilty of going through and spreading these things that support our positions without necessarily doing all the due diligence. We like to knee jerk. We feel outraged, sometimes justified, sometimes not. You know, we as atheists are still human beings. We're still subject to bias. We're still, you know, sometimes prone to getting things wrong. And so one thing about all of the blow up of the last several months, it's sort of drawn a circle for me about the fact that, you know, atheism doesn't mean we're not human beings. Atheism isn't a guarantee that we're going to always find that other atheists are the best people who are doing things for the best reasons, promoting the best ideas, cultivating the best in each other. But beyond all of that, I came away with, and it's the reason I did the show I did last Tuesday, I came away with just a desire to see people de-escalate. I've just come to sort of embrace that word. How many times has somebody said something we disagreed with and we escalate, we ramp up, we throw gasoline on every spark, we flip out, we try to rally everybody to our sides. You know, we speak at each other through a bullhorn, and we're not speaking, we're shouting. And I think if only we would stop and maybe listen a bit more and treat each other a bit more, especially online, the way we would over a cup of coffee, how many of our problems might be solved? And then beyond that, the people who are trolling just because they want to ride someone else's coattails into the spotlight, or because they love the attention, or they just want to see the world burn. I mean, I try not to give too many of those people the time of day, because drama feeds on itself, and this drama is, for many of them, their oxygen. It's hard for me sometimes, but if I try not to feed the beast.
That was kind of my issue, that I felt like from the very beginning, I was calling for us to act like humanists, to show compassion, even to people who we think are behaving abhorrently. Show that compassion. Why are they doing that? Why would he tweet that? Why are they cheering? Let's be humanists, even to the people who we think are assholes, and dig a little deeper and find out what's going on. Do we see a murderer and say, well, he killed someone, lock him in a box, throw away the key, let him starve to death? No, not as humanists, we don't. As humanists, we say, what caused you to want to hurt people? Where's that compassion going? And I was calling for that, Seth. I was saying, where's our compassion? Let's look deeper into this. And you know what they said about me? What they said about me was, I'm no longer a humanist because I wouldn't confront the evil. And that's exactly what I was calling for, is more compassion.
Yeah, I think the argument, Dave, though, is that if we see a murderer, we do see them as a human being. But the humanist in us is going to have to, we have to be more concerned about potential victims and the families of previous victims. We have to be more concerned about someone else first. It becomes a question of priorities. And when you stop and focus on the murderer first, you realize how people can take that ball and just run with it, right?
I didn't, though. I didn't say, hey, you guys leave Sargon alone. I didn't defend him. I said, maybe they were cheering for something else. And then I was told I had defended the murderer. And that is the religious mentality that I'm asking atheists to go, look, when you were a Christian and you looked outward at atheists and non-believers and thought everyone who was a non-believer was a Satanist, or everyone who's a non-believer can't be as moral as I, or if you're not with me, you're against me. If you're not pro-Jesus, you're pro-Satan. You didn't realize you were in the religious mindset until you pulled your head out of it, looked around and went, oh my gosh. I've been living in a world of black and white, and I've ignored all the gray. And I think so many atheists have accidentally walked back into that religious mindset without even realizing it.
I don't know if it's a religious mindset. I just think it may be a human one, especially in the age of the internet. I think nuance is dying on the vine, and we're going to have to take great pains to try to revive it. I don't think, David, you're going to change minds on Twitter. That's probably the other mistake I would have advised you against. And you and I can disagree on this. I mean, I try to communicate on Twitter, and there have been times when I've engaged, but I don't know that you can communicate a nuanced position at 140 characters, man. There's so many opportunities. I mean, Dawkins is a great example of this, where he'll tweet something which requires nuance, and Twitter's a clumsy forum for that stuff. And anybody and everybody can grab any part of that post and just go off the chain with it, you know, and that's a challenge, man.
Yeah, my point isn't necessarily to change minds when I tweet something like that. My point is to make people think about their position.
But if you pull yourself off Facebook, but now you're on Twitter, a more limited forum for this type of stuff. What are you doing, Dave? You know
what I'm saying? on purpose, because no one can send me a novel with 19 straw men of my character. They have to consolidate their point and get right to it. And you know what? When they do a tag directly that I'm alt-right, I reply and say, what is something I've said that's alt-right? Well, I just feel you've been going that direction. Okay, tell me what I've said that makes you believe I'm alt-right. Well, you were anti-Antifa. Okay, so there's only two options. I'm either Antifa or I'm Richard Spencer. No, there's a gray area. Okay, so you can dive down with simple questions, and I implore the Socratic method to come to find out. And at the end, they'll say, okay, well, maybe you didn't. Maybe for some reason I just felt that way. Yeah, you felt that way because of the long-winded Facebook post attacking my character, and you believed things without evidence, allowed that to whip you up in a frenzy, and found out that David is suppressively reasonable because he has the inability to confront evil. All I'm doing is pausing to say, guys, let's be humanists. Maybe there's more to the story.
No, only a Nazi would say that, Dave. I'm sorry.
I love you, Seth.
I know. Look, I see it in reverse. Like, Twitter to me is a bit more frustrating. I like to respond maybe once, twice, possibly three or four times, but I've made a commitment to myself as best I can, as hard as it is not to get sucked in, not to get into this nonstop bam, 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 you know, all day.
Seth, if you tried for years.
Will suck time, the energy, your will to live if you don't compartmentalize and focus on the main picture, man.
How long did you and I both avoid any of this? I mean, there would be people fighting in the community. You and I would interview both of them. We didn't take sides. We didn't eventually somehow you get dragged in to fighting, and people accuse you of things you didn't do, and then you sit there deciding, do I defend myself and get in the weeds with this person, or do I ignore it and allow that person to control the narrative about my character?
I get that. I mean, you want to go in and you want to make a statement for the record to correct the record, and I totally support that. I just think, you know, it's hard for us with so many other bigger battles to fight not to, but sometimes I think we have to make a commitment to not allow ourselves to get lost in the weeds.
Here's my battle, though, Seth. My battle is dogma. Incorrect information being spread around with emotion instead of evidence. That's my battle. My show is called Dogma Debate because of that reason. I know that there are Democrats and liberals with dogma, just like there are members of the alt-right and white supremacists who have dogma, just like there are Christians with dogma and atheists with dogma. And so when I see my fellow atheists who I know are reasonable, skeptical people who ask for evidence in every other aspect of their lives, make a broad assumption or a jump to an immediate black or white false dichotomy type insult because of one thing or because of a tweet or because of a cheer or because of something, I just go, guys, remember our roots. Like, remember when we were requesting evidence and being humanists and extending that olive branch? Let's not lose that. Let's not become religious again.
All right, well, I'll give you that caveat that to engage someone who's genuinely engaging back, I buy that. But I'm talking about the trolls, the people who want to derail the train, the people who take joy and pleasure in distraction.
Yeah, no,
I mean, they'll only take as much oxygen as we give them to a degree.
I agree. 95% of the time, Seth, I don't respond.
All right, fair enough.
I don't even see it.
Sometimes online, I'm talking to you through my computer. I'm like, David, stop wasting your time. They're not listening. And not everybody, but there are some specific people. I'm like, stop wasting your time. Jesus Christ, we have so much other work to do.
I think I'm just naive, Seth. I think I see the best in everybody. I think I see people who are being trolls, and I go, what is it that you really want? What's causing you to be so hateful?
I kind of get a Mother Teresa vibe from you there, Dave. I mean, I'm trying to, you know, like, I try to reach out through to help people who are they're victims of dogma. You know, some people are going to latch onto that and think it might sound a bit haughty.
6 years of my show that I'm done.
But now hear what I'm saying, Dave. I totally agree. Look, you have a huge palette of guests on your show. You'll talk to pretty much anybody. So I agree. I honestly would back you up in that. You will speak to anybody, almost anybody, and you're genuinely good, usually good at listening. You want to find out what their positions are. You have a conversation about those positions. It is one of the reasons that I support and hope others will support Dogma Debate, because I think you're having conversations that are producing fruit, that are effective. I like the fact that you genuinely do love people and that you don't fit into this awful cookie cutter that many people are throwing out there about you. Agree, disagree. We can have our moments where we don't intersect, where we even dislike each other. But, you know, Dave Smalley's not the enemy. And that's why I'm glad to have him on the radio, because having known the guy for a few years, you know, and he knows me, we know each other warts and all. I feel like that at the end of the day, we both care about people. Dave, I really do. I'm convinced you do care about people and that you want to be a part of the solution out there. And I think you and I provided just now an example of two people who don't line up on something, on a specific thing, but manage to actually have an amicable exchange, a good faith, goodwill hour on the radio talking like we might over a beer or coffee without having to make the other person a villain so that we could be the hero. And I hope the listeners who are sort of watching this happen, you know, can be encouraged that it is possible.
And I appreciate you having me. And I know people are going to latch on to certain aspects of what I say. And, oh, he's playing the victim. Oh, he's Mother Teresa. Oh, he's propping himself up. And look, and if I didn't do that and I was like, yeah, well, screw you guys, Sargon's the best, then I would have a whole other portion of people hating on me. It doesn't matter, right? So I'm just going to be genuine. I'm going to say the things that I honestly believe. And you're right, Seth. I think that's our bigger connect whenever you talk about how we have so much in common. David Smalley's not the enemy. Seth Andrews is not the enemy, right? It's not that. It's we have this huge religious right trying to force religion on us. We need to stand together, embrace our differences. Let's passionately debate our differences. But let's not cast out other people as awful or disgusting or Nazis or rape defenders. Let's back off the blanket insults. Let's be humanists and let's disagree. And that was my, when I gave the speech in Sacramento at the state capitol, that was my overarching point, is if we don't maintain the separation of church and state, none of our other goals are even attainable. Let's keep fighting for the right to be able to disagree with one another. And we need each other to do that.
I like that phrase out there that says, it's a sentence that says, it's not what you're called, it's what you answer to. And there's some truth to that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've in my own life come to the point where I know my heart. I think the audience knows my heart. Who'd have thought that you and I would ever be considered controversial figures in the atheist? You and I are like the designated drivers of the atheist movement. So it's just this weird twilight zone that you and I would ever be considered controversial. But I appreciate you. I appreciate your heart and character. I appreciate the work that you do with Dogma Debate. I'm hugely excited for your success out there, and I hope it continues, my friend. And in the meantime, I wish you and your family a great holiday as they approach, and we'll rendezvous again here down the road, okay?
Same here, Seth. It's an honor not only to work with you as an activist, but to call you a friend. I do appreciate you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.